Welcome to the Action Research Podcast. Each episode, Action Research experts Adam and Joe explore facets of this research methodology. Speaking with experienced and emerging action researchers, they aim to contribute to this important and growing field and understand the nuance and process of action research in action. Thanks for tuning in. Now, onto your hosts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Action Research Podcast. It's been a while. Really excited to be back recording with my host, Joe. I'm Adam Stieglitz. And today we have a guest, a new guest. His name is Joseph Winberry, PhD, is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill School of Information and Library Science. Much of his teaching and research revolves around critical librarianship, information marginalization, and older adults. Fun fact, he considers his grandmother, who's now 93, as one of his best friends, and enjoyed skydiving with her for her 80th birthday. Joseph, how's it going? What's going on? Thanks for coming on the Action Research Podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you both for having me.
So my first question is, now that she's 93, does your grandmother plan on doing any more skydiving?
Well, she actually did want to go skydiving for her 90th birthday, and her doctor suggested that wouldn't be the best thing to do. But what one of my big memories from when we went skydiving is that she enjoyed herself, except that she really hated that she had to jump with someone else since she didn't have the training. She wanted to jump by herself. But other than that, we both had a good time.
That's awesome. I hope that I am able-bodied enough to do some skydiving in my 80s. I think that's a really cool thing. So you're originally from Tennessee. Is that correct? I know you went to Tennessee.
Well, that's where I got my PhD from. Yes.
Okay. Where'd you grow up?
So I grew up on Long Island, New York, and in the Piedmont of North Carolina. And that's where I did my undergrad work in history and political science, and then later relocated to East Tennessee, the Knoxville area. And that's really where I was working in nonprofits, and then kind of came to a crossroads. And that was really kind of the beginning of my journey as an action researcher.
Can you tell us a little bit about that crossroads?
Sure, absolutely. So I had been working in nonprofits for a couple of years, but my passion up to that point had really been history. So I had this kind of opportunity where I found myself, I had gotten accepted into the University of Tennessee's Master's of Information Science program. And I had decided that I was going to become an archivist. But around the same time, I had also been looking for a new job in the nonprofit space. And by chance, I had come across and gotten an interview for a job at the local office on aging, where I would be spearheading their first ever program in response to elder abuse in the community. And I had really thought, you know, okay, I want to become an archivist. That's really what I thought I wanted to do. But I really felt compelled by this opportunity to respond to elder abuse. Like, my grandparents and their friends had been such an important part of my life, and the idea of people taking advantage of older people in the community where I lived just really struck me as, you know, an issue of justice that I had an opportunity there to do something about. So I decided to take that job. 1 year later, I started in the master's program, and I was still working at the Office on Aging at that time. At that point, I had come to realize the role that information really plays in society, and therefore, you know, how it can make the world a better place or a worse one, how we create information, how we share it, how we make it available, how we hide it from people, all those sorts of things. I was kind of seeing that oftentimes there are problems that don't really have clear solutions. And I think the studying of the process and working through that process with others would be really important for finding out ways to address problems.
I found myself connecting with this idea of information marginalization. And I know we're going to dive a little bit deeper into your studies, especially from an action research perspective. But I was wondering if you could enlighten myself and our audience a little bit about this idea of information marginalization and kind of what that looks like from a theoretical lens. I think that'll help ground our conversation moving forward today.
Absolutely. So the concept of information marginalization was first introduced in a paper in 2019 by Amelia Gibson and John Martin. And as I was doing, as I was starting kind of the community work around what would eventually become my dissertation, I came across this article, and it was so powerful and so representative a lot of what I was seeing in my community. And essentially kind of the main crux of information marginalization is this idea that it is not a coincidence often when there is missing information for particular groups. Sometimes the absence of information for them is intentional. Sometimes it is unintentional. But either way, there is a reason that you find marginalized groups often lack the information they need to get the help and to kind of move forward in the same way as any other person. And so this original paper looked at the needs of parents of children with disabilities. It was parents of color and the needs of their children with disabilities. And looking at that and kind of translating it into my work, three kind of theoretical components were emerging that were important, one of which is information needs, thinking, you know, what kind of information do people need for a particular problem they're experiencing? And then information barriers, what are the barriers that exist to getting the information need met? And then ultimately, information practices. What practices, in the case of my study, we're looking at, you know, what could organizations do to help remove these barriers? Because in Gibson and Martin's article, they had found that oftentimes these parents knew that they lacked information. They knew that they were at a disadvantage, but they didn't have the time and the energy to help change these systems. They had other things that they needed to do. But that was something that really struck at me, you know, the role that research could play maybe in changing some of these real world information systems in practice. And that was kind of, that mindset is really kind of what set me off of using information marginalization as the lens for my study.
All right, I think the first question as always is, in the most succinct way, how would you define what is action research?
I think, you know, there are certainly different types of action research. And a lot of my work so far has been around community-based participatory action research. But what I will say overall is, when I think about kind of a general definition of action research, I think of action research as being about the process of engaging with the problem and taking steps in order to address that problem that provide practical solutions, but also some theoretical insights that others might be able to use for solving a similar problem.
Okay, great. And maybe that's a good segue into another question then. What is community-based participatory action research?
Well, community-based participatory action research really involves bringing together community partners, community members, who are going to be affected by whatever issue that you are trying to address. So in the case of my dissertation study, which I know we'll talk more about, it was around the needs of LGBT older adults. So when I was thinking about this, we needed to make sure that we brought in LGBT older adults into the study, not just in the sense of, you know, doing interviews with them, what do you think, but also as part of the process of identifying what problems should be focused on and kind of what do some of those solutions look like. So I think, you know, you can't do what I would also call CBPR study without bringing in the community who you are trying to assist, because it's not just about being based in the community, it's also being about being led by the community and addressing issues that they believe are important.
So given that, what would you say is critical to success in an action research investigation?
I think there are a few things. Number one is time. It takes a long time to do an action research study. And so that would be something that I would encourage anyone who was thinking about that, really consider the amount of time that it would take. Also, relationships. I think, you know, it doesn't really matter. I think almost every form of action research, there are some element of relationships there that go into creating the solutions. So, you know, in addition to taking time, make sure that you also develop relationships. Another thing I would say there is just having an open mind and flexibility about the work that you're doing. I think it's really easy for us as researchers doing anything with action research to think, okay, this is the vision that I have for this project. But the whole purpose of doing this work really, right, is to create solutions and helping make those solutions sustainable. So and part of doing that is really getting an understanding of what the real problems are once you've been in the research process a little bit, and not just allowing yourself to be iterative and learn as you go with others, instead of being too prescriptive of, you know, this is what the outcome is expected to be.
So I was wondering if you have any specific advice to graduate students who are considering action research for as their methodology for their thesis or dissertation.
Yes, that is a great question. I thank you so much for asking it, because I think, at least in my case, I didn't have a great deal of exposure to action research prior to starting to think about using it for my dissertation. And, you know, there were some people along that journey who really discouraged me doing action research because they felt that it would take too long. And you know, there are also, I think sometimes, unfortunately, in academia, I think there is some pushback against the value of action research. And I definitely experienced some of that. So I would say for students who are thinking about this, thinking about using action research, number one, I would not, it is important, right? You're on a timeline and you have to take that timeline into consideration. But this is your project, and this is something that you have to have a passion about. I can tell you from, you know, less than a year ago, a lot of late nights working on this project alone. If it wasn't something that I had a passion for, I don't know that I could have done it. So even though it is, you're right, you want to be as practical as you can be. And sometimes really the best dissertation is a done dissertation. But at the same time, you want to make sure that you're working on something that you are passionate about, that you are willing to get up early to work on, stay up late to work on, engage with the community if that's your interest. Action research, I think, is kind of a smaller area in a lot of fields, especially in information science. So those of us who do that work and find it to be so important, we want to share with you and we want to see you be successful in doing that. So follow your passions and don't be afraid to reach out when you need some additional insights.
Man, those are really excellent responses. Really grateful for that. So thank you. Joe, I think I'm going to pass the mic back to you. I don't know if you have any follow-up insights or questions from that profound lightning round, or perhaps it's a good time to turn to some of the more detailed oriented questions that we have related to Joseph's study.
So the first question, I guess, is what brought you to community-based participatory action research in general?
Yeah, well, I think it would be best for me to kind of talk a little bit about information sciences first. That might provide a little bit more context for kind of my individual journey with community-based participatory research. But so information science, it's a really interesting field because it's such a broad field. It covers so much. And really, if you think about just the concept of information, right, is in everything. So information science is connected to really, it's a very interdisciplinary because it relates to every field out there. You know, whether you are in social work or you are in physics or you are in English, there are connections there to information. So that's something that's really important to know about information science, is just how interdisciplinary it is. And for a lot of my work has focused on the library side of information sciences, and that's certainly a major part, but you know, there are so many other elements to that also, like how do people user experience, how do people engage with a website, for instance, how do they navigate that maybe if they've never used that before? Or how do people retrieve information? I think, you know, a lot of we don't realize, like, you know, we think kind of like, okay, Google was developed and that's a great resource. But a lot of people don't know that there was a lot of years and years of research that went into making something like Google be so workable for average people. And information science played a big role in that. But also things like a lot of my work is related to social justice. And so when we are looking at both information, but also things like technology, when we find that there is technology, right, that works for people with lighter skin, but not with people with darker skin. There's a very common example is in the bathroom, sometimes with the automatic soap and water, depending on the color of your skin, you might have more ability to use those. And there are so many different examples like that. And a lot of that gets into, you know, the social justice side of information and technology. So it is something, you know, when you're talking about information science, you're talking about really the human side of technology and of information community and institutions like libraries, but also really just kind of any institution out there, because information is part of it all. And so in kind of thinking about how this has shaped my work and especially as it relates to action research, when it came time to start thinking about my dissertation project more, I really reflected back on this varied experience I had had working at the Office on Aging, being in this master's program, and seeing how these things interacted. And one of the things that I really discovered was too often times when we're trying to solve problems, I mean, when we're trying to engage with problems, it's really about getting past problems. Kind of like the example, rather, that Gibson and Martin give in their article, these marginalized groups, they recognize the challenges that exist, but they're just trying to get through the day to day. They don't have the time and energy and oftentimes the influence to make these real changes. And so how I had this kind of made clear to me is when I was working at the Office on Aging, I was going around and talking to all different sorts of community groups about elder abuse. And one group that I went to go speak with was a group of older gay men. And what I found in talking with them is they were less concerned about elder abuse specifically as they were more concerned with what is going to happen to me as I get older. As a gay man from a particular generation, when I came out or when I was kicked out of the closet, for some folks, they lost jobs, they lost family connections, they lost friends. And the consequences of all those things had followed them throughout their lives. And so when we think about this from an information perspective, if you are a straight couple, and you, if it is time maybe that you and your spouse need to go to a long-term care facility, very typically, right, you can just look up a facility, maybe go online, find one, and okay, this seems like a good facility, has good ratings, I can go here. If you are a gay couple or an LGBT couple, you have added information needs. You need to know, if me and my spouse go to this facility, are we going to be accepted by other people in the community? Are the caregivers going to treat us with dignity and respect? And all these other questions, which oftentimes are not made available on the website. So you have an additional burden of maybe of that history of discrimination that you have to contend with. And then you also have these additional information needs that you need access to. And oftentimes there's barriers to getting that information. So that was something that really stood out. You know, that was a great example, I thought, of information marginalization. And I realized that it wasn't going to be enough to just say to them, okay, what needs do you have around aging? And just write that up and publish it in a social science journal and be like, okay, here are the problems. As a gay man myself, I felt like so much of my life was because of so many of the benefits that I have in society. Like, I have a husband and I'm able to be out in my work and my life. So much of that is because of the sacrifices that this generation of men made. And so for me, it wasn't enough to stop at just saying, okay, here are the problems. We need to work towards solutions. So that was something that really became the focus of the project. And I had experience with community organizing, community building, in my role at the Office on Aging previously and in other things that I had done. So I was not totally new to it from the community engagement perspective, but thinking about it as a lens for research, that was new. But I recognize that going back to that original problem introduced by information marginalization, the idea that folks are just trying to get through the day to day, they don't have an ability necessarily to change these systems. We as professionals, as researchers, we have an ability and an obligation, I feel, to at least try to change these marginalizing systems when we can.
Great. Mm-hmm. So thank you for all that I have a follow-up question. So in your field, did you take a class on action research? Who were some of the people you read to kind of clue you into the fact that, you know, based on this motivation, based on your experiences, based on your passion for this work, this could be a particular paradigm for you to use in your dissertation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think like a lot of people read a lot of the classic work by Lewin and others around action research. But the ones that were most powerful for me were the ones in information sciences that did exist, because a 2021 study showed that there have not been a whole lot of action research studies in library and information sciences. There's definitely been some over the years. And I think in the last few years, a few more people have been doing that. But some of the most important ones for me were Bharat Mehra, who is one of the leading scholars of action research and community-based research in information sciences. And I happened to have the opportunity by chance of working with him starting as a master's student. And he ended up being on my committee for the dissertation. So his work has been extremely important. He's a very prolific author. So there was a lot of important and helpful information there. Also, the research done by Vanessa Kitsey, who is another information science researcher, she actually also did a little bit of work around information marginalization and LGBT populations and has done action research projects with them. So that was another perspective that was very helpful. She didn't focus specifically on older LGBT people, but there was a lot of insights there. But it was really helpful to kind of to also read action research studies across different disciplines.
Great, thanks. So one last follow-up question, then Adam, you can hop in. I'm sure you have lots of questions too. So you said you got some pushback about action research in during your dissertation and in the field. So can you talk a little bit about that too?
Sure. A lot, like I think a lot of the major feedback that I had about action research as a methodology was the concern around time. That was the number one thing that was said. You know, are you going to have enough time to do this? Can you make it work? And it was helpful in my case that, you know, I had worked in the field of aging services. So I had relationships and things. So I wasn't starting from scratch. But I guess not really everyone who said this to me in my program and elsewhere necessarily knew all of that about my background. Also about my focus on older people and, you know, marginalized populations like LGBT people. There are people that said, you know, don't do that. Or, you know, you're an information science scholar, not a gerontologist. As hopefully the listeners have kind of figured out based on my previous descriptions, information science is very broad and means a lot of different things, and depending on the kind of work that you're doing. But I also, you know, I heard some things and kind of inferred some things about the practice focus of action research in information science. And especially, you know, a lot of the work we do, like librarianship, but in other places, it's so much about practice. It's a professional field about helping people. But there have been so many scholars who have noted the lack of focus on that sometimes in their research, kind of developing theory from within our field that is going to be relatable to our practitioners. But working in a field that really is so much about practice and helping people, I really thought it was important for this study to have that practice element, that real world connection.
So what I'm curious to hear about, given that, is like, what did you do from an action research lens to get out there and involve the communities? You said you utilized CBPAR as part of your method. And I know that you did various types of mixed method studies, surveys, interviews, that sort of thing. But walk us through like the process of implementing an action research investigation specific to your study and the problem that you identified.
Yeah, absolutely. So the first step is kind of what I said. I saw a problem that I thought was there based on talking with the older gay men, but I thought it was important. I wanted to hear more from the LGBT community about this, taking this larger idea of their concerns about aging and boiling that down into really what more were their specific concerns about that versus me kind of just assuming based on one conversation what that would be. How I did this was I did interviews with 25 LGBT older adults across East Tennessee, and I talked to them about what were their needs around aging, as they saw them? What barriers do they expect to getting those needs met? And what could organizations like the Office on Aging that I had previously worked at, what could they do to help ensure that you are able to age with dignity and respect? I then was able to develop a strategic plan that the Office on Aging would be able to implement. And from the beginning, I had talked with a lot of folks, individuals informally, but also the leadership of the Office on Aging and other community organizations. So they knew this process was ongoing. They helped me think about some of the questions, and so did LGBT community members. So it really, throughout the entire process of putting this together, even though it was my dissertation study, I had input from other folks and got the community perspective on things. But so after doing those interviews and coming up with a strategic plan, those same folks, about 19 of those original 25, came back, and across 5 focus groups, we talked about, here is the strategic plan based on these interviews. What do you think? And so they were able to look at some of the needs that emerged and the barriers, and some of the needs were things like there needed to be cultural competency, you know, when we're providing services, where some of the participants were like, you know, I would love to go to a provider that is just there to serve LGBT older adults. But if I'm going to go to a provider that serves everyone, they really have to be prepared to serve everyone. So those are some of the sorts of needs that came up. So based on that, once we kind of finalized it with the focus group, I did a survey. It was actually a qualitative survey where I just sent some of these elements from the strategic plan to other community providers to get their insights as we finalized it, to see what they had, what they thought about what was raised. And there were some really interesting responses to that. But afterwards, when it came time to implementation, one of the goals of the plan, it became really clear that it was important to have some kind of mechanism, some kind of committee that would help ensure that the strategic plan was going to be implemented. So we created what is called the Aging Rainbow Coalition, or ARC, you know, the first entity to try to help LGBT older people as they age in East Tennessee. And this is something that exists within the Knoxville, Tennessee Office on Aging. And so since March of 2023, we have been meeting regularly to implement the plan and, you know, making sure that the Office on Aging and other community organizations are doing what they can to ensure that this population gets the support that they need.
So what I heard was, based on your dissertation and based on your community-based approach, you identified a very clear need, and then you were able to mobilize some resources to actually create a government entity or subdivision to address that need. Is that accurate?
Yeah, like I guess a good way to say would be the subdivision. It's an entity within the Office on Aging, because they have like 25 programs for older people. And, you know, kind of one of the first things that we found, like I said, was, you know, if we're going to have services that are available to all people, we have to make sure that the service providers are capable of serving all people. So it made a lot of sense to have it within the Office on Aging, since they are already serving older people.
Right. No, I think that's just a great example of how thinking through things in a way that is kind of based in that action research paradigm can actually facilitate meaningful, concrete changes. And actually, I'm assuming there's some government funding available to the subdivision for people to be employed to work on these problems. So that's huge. So congratulations on that. I mean, that's great to hear.
Thank you. Yeah, we definitely have some staff support from the Office on Aging, and we're as an entity, we're working together on grants, and we've gotten some grants to implement some of the elements of the plan, and some that, you know, we're still looking for opportunities. But we've been meeting and working on this regularly since March of 2023, and it's continuing, and, you know, it's going to continue for the foreseeable future, you know, at least a few years, and probably on and on, because, you know, the action continually needs to happen in order to keep the solutions coming.
There were kind of a few points that I wanted to pull out from your response to that question to sort of that made me recognize or perhaps distinguish this as an action research study from a more traditional approach to investigation, which is kind of what I was trying to get to the bottom of with that question with our listeners in mind, because you are using relatively traditional methods, right? You hear about like focus groups and interviews and surveys, and sometimes I think students or people in their graduate studies think that because those are traditional methods, they can't be used as action research methods or incorporated into that methodology. But, you know, hearing you say that you worked with the community to design questions, and you were kind of sampling, always incorporating their input to inform these various iterations of data collection, that you co-collaborated on the strategic plan design and ultimately created this ARC coalition, I think that does a really good job of embodying, some of the characteristics of action research. And just that iterative cycle, I think, is very well displayed in your study, in your response to that question, at least. And the fact that it's continuing on past your studies even more so, I think, is what's most important and kind of addresses some of the pushback that you receive.
One of the kind of the real challenges I had in this study was with my institutional review board, because, you know, this is a community-based study. Really, every element, you know, from the interview questions to the this is the process that we're going to follow for the strategic plan, all of this had input from community members, whether it was these community partners like the Office on Aging and also the local Pride Center and some other smaller organizations that exist, their representatives, but also people who were members of this population who were at least 50 years and older, LGBT, a lot of whom were well into their 70s. It was kind of a little bit difficult to explain that to the institutional review board, right? That have a very strict, oftentimes, mindset of this is when research begins, this is when it ends. And so they ultimately did work with me, and kind of one of the methods that I haven't really talked about, but there was a lot of kind of a participant researcher role of me being part and my observations of working on this whole process, kind of observing people in informal settings, because there was so much learned for this study that emerged from outside the interviews or emerged from outside the focus group. It really was on kind of looking at this process of how do we identify a problem that we can try to address, and how do we bring people together around not just finding, you know, not doing what Joseph thinks we should do for this study, but what really does the community want? And so in my dissertation, I really try to talk about the importance of informal research method or data collection, I guess I should say, in this process. So that was something at first. Ultimately, you know, IRB was able to, like, okay, you know, if you can think about this kind of informal data collection that you did in a way that doesn't identify people and things like that, it can get around some of those IRB requirements and still kind of keep the spirit of a community engaged study, which is not just me, the researcher, saying this is what we're going to do, but really kind of thinking about this and living this as a collaborative process, which is what it was and what it continues to be.
That's great. Thank you. Shifting gears slightly, but on the same track, a lot of, especially my doctoral students, are wondering about positionality and reflexivity. And I know that's a huge part of community-based participatory action research in general. So I was just curious, as a member of the LGBT community, how does your positionality, how does the way in which you're thinking about this, how did that, those various mixes of identities as a scholar, as somebody working on the Office of Aging, how did those different identities and positions within the social space affect how you made decisions, how you were thinking about how to really orient what the community wanted rather than what Joseph wants, for example?
Absolutely. And that is such an important question. So I thank you very much for asking it. And, you know, this was something I do address in my study a little bit with my kind of pointing out my positionality. Like you said, I am a member of the LGBT community, but I am not someone who would be considered older. I'm younger than 50, younger than 60, however you want to define that. You know, I am younger than that. So, and I've had, because of that, the generational differences, I've had a different experience to what it means to be a gay man than the people in my study. And also, as someone who has worked in aging services, who understands kind of how it operates. So all of this, I try to be very upfront in my study and recognizing that, you know, this is my positionality, where I'm coming from in engaging with this study. You know, when we're thinking about qualitative research in general, I think that the subjectivity piece of of kind of the work that we're doing is important. How I approach this study and how it ultimately looked does look different because of my background. If you did it, Joe, or Adam did it, or someone else did it, you know, that I think that's kind of an inevitable aspect of it. But I also think it's part of what makes it unique and worthwhile. And I would say, too, that it was very important that despite this background, that I did want to center the perspectives of the community. So as I was doing the interviews and things, I engaged with member checking and bracketing and things to try to, as best as I could, kind of put my perspective to the side. But I think, and I definitely think that, you know, you could look at the data and see very clearly where, you know, these needs emerged from what participants told me. And I think a lot of my positionality, a lot of my knowledge in this area helped them, helped the community on track of making this, of kind of achieving what they had said they wanted to achieve. But I would say to any student who was thinking about doing an action research study, your positionality is there, whether you want to say it is or not. So I encourage you to be upfront and to let the reader know that, and they can come to their own judgments about the value. You know, don't be afraid of charting new territory or what seems to you that might be new territory. So much of this work is because of researchers who have come before us who were not afraid to do that. So whether that's like in the different methods that you're using within action research or the populations that you're working with, or, you know, whether you're using strategic planning as your action, your form of action or something else, you know, don't be afraid to take risks, and don't be afraid to engage the community. Remember the reason that why we are all doing this work, right? We believe in the importance and the power of taking action. And so if you keep all this in mind, I know that you will be successful. And remember, there are researchers like myself and others who would be happy to talk with you as you have questions. And thank you to anyone who's listening to this for the work that you're doing and the work that you will do with action research.
Excellent. Thank you, Joseph. Dr. Winberry, I should say. Thank you very much. Thanks for reaching out to us and coming on today to discuss your research and share such valuable and insightful knowledge with our listener base. To our listeners out there, feel free to reach out to Joe or I as well. We'd love to have you on and hear about the innovative work that you're doing in the field. Joseph, thanks again for coming on.
I just want to say, if I can, thank you, Joe and Adam and your team for putting this together and making this available. It was a great resource to me as a student, and I know it will be moving forward into many others as well. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Our pleasure. Joe, it was great catching up with you, Joe and Joseph, both of you. And we'll chat again soon.
All right. Yep. Thanks, Joseph. Great to meet you. Great to talk to you. Adam, great to chat.
You can subscribe to our podcast on most major podcast distribution platforms, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Action Research Podcast, created by Adam Stieglitz, Joe Levitan, Shika DeWalker, Corey Legasic, and Vanessa Gold.